Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and The Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rockwell. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction, and welcome to The Sync Report. So let's welcome our producer, Paula Flack. Hey, Paula, how are you?
Hey, Colin, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, and good. The weather is picking up, which is nice. How about you tell me who's coming on the show this week, Paula?
Yay!
Okay, we have two guests on the show this week. Oh. I'll tell you about them one by one. First, we have my friend, Michelle DeVries, on the show. Michelle's career in the music industry spans more than 20 years in music publishing, management, production, broadcasting, and recorded music in both the UK and the US. She was head of A&R at Hit and Run Music Publishing in London, later running the New York office. And Michelle is an expert on music history with a vast knowledge of music rights and licensing, scoring, and on the music industry itself. Michelle's clients include Full Well, 73, Chambers Management, the Michael J. Fox Foundation, Pulse Films, and Aardman Animation. And her most recent music supervision projects include the award-winning productions Bross, After the Screaming Stops for the BBC, Hitsville, The Making of Motown, The Capture, another drama for the BBC, Shaun the Sheep, Farmageddon, NASA Among the Stars for Disney+, I Am Bolt, a documentary about the athlete Usain Bolt, I Boy on Netflix, and the acclaimed sports series All or Nothing for Amazon Prime.
Incredible.
She is currently working on, dare I say it, Jason? She is currently working on Farron Blackburn's film Mary's Monster, which looks at the life of Mary Shelley during the period she was writing Frankenstein, and happens to also be one of Rose's productions. Outside of music, Michelle is the co-founder of the fantastic charity Star Boot Sale, which has so far raised more than £110,000 to help refugees in Syria and Jordan.
Amazing. Oh my God.
I know. Let's welcome Michelle DeVries, and then I'm going to also introduce Rupert.
Welcome, Michelle.
Wow. Welcome Michelle.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paula. That's an amazing introduction. I don't recognise myself. I'll give you the money later.
Fantastic. You've got my address, so I know that's... we also have another guest on the show today.
Oh, wow.
Rupert Hollier is the creative director of Atlantic Screen Music and supervision agency Red 5. Rupert has worked in music publishing for both MCS and Dutch music publisher Imogen Music, and he founded Metropolis Music Publishing. He has represented the Rodgers and Hammerstein and Boosie and Hawkes catalogues, plus contemporary artists including Daft Punk, Mark Ronson, Pink Floyd and Genesis. He's worked with brands including Reebok, Skoda, Hyundai and Tesco, as well as several successful US, UK and European-based films. In 2016, Rupert won both Best TV Ad and Overall Sync of the Year as Music Supervisor at the Music Week Sync Awards, and is a co-founder and senior board member of the UK and European Guild of Music Supervisors. Rupert has supervised over 60 films and TV series, including the Oscar-nominated and BAFTA-winning film The Wife and the BAFTA-nominated biopic McQueen. Let's also please welcome Rupert to the stage.
Welcome, Rupert.
Hey, everyone. Nice to see you all. Paula, you are behind on my agent.
I aim to please.
Really nice to be here. Thanks, guys.
What a lineup. My God.
Absolutely. Well, welcome, Michelle, and welcome, Rupert, to the show. I'll start with you, Michelle, if that's okay. You know, it's great to have you with us on the show. And I'm very excited to hear about your journey in this industry. I know the role of a music supervisor is a complex job. Can we go back to the beginning of your career? How have your early experiences served you in your current position? How have they fed into that?
So I'm now a music supervisor full time, and that's what I do. But I started off, actually, my original plan was to be a recording engineer. And my first job, I walked into a studio, a really small studio in London, asking them if they needed anyone. And they said, yes, we do. The person who makes the tea left this morning. He's just been signed to a record deal. Can you start now? So that was how I started. And I made the tea on some like really fun little projects, including the composer of Doctor Who at the time and a few films, and also the guy that was responsible for the Birdie song, if you remember that. I sort of worked my way up and wanted to become a recording engineer, and I then worked in larger studios at the weekends and things like that. But it did become, this was in the 90s, and sadly at that time, it was a little bit misogynistic, and I started getting clients saying they didn't want a woman in the recording studio. Yeah, this was the 90s. And so it sort of became quite abundantly clear that I wouldn't really be able to get to the top of where I wanted to go with that. And I would just always sort of continue making the tea, really. So I moved into publishing, and I signed some songwriters to my own publishing label. And they got then re-signed to a company called Hit & Run, which was run and owned by Genesis's manager, Tony Smith. And it was a really, really great boutique publishing company. And it had fantastic artists, fantastic songwriters. And it was just a really prestigious, prestigious company. And they offered me a job in New York. I went over to New York, and I started off in A&R there, signing songwriters, working with artists, and pitching songs as well for film and TV at the time. I have a really funny story, actually. I thought I was only about 22, and I got a sort of list of all music supervisors in LA. And at that time, it was quite a new career and a new position. Music supervisors weren't really well known in those days. And I used to be too scared to contact the head of the company. So I always used to contact their number two. And I'd say, oh, I've been in touch with your company before. I've got some great songs to send you for your film. And I contacted one lady, and I said, oh, I've been in touch with Dylan. I had a really good chat with him a few weeks ago. She was the president of the company. She was the vice president of the company. And she said, Dylan, that's really interesting. How was the conversation? I said, oh, he was great. He told me to contact you. And she said, oh, that's interesting, because Dylan's actually my dog. And I put him on the, I put his name up to get rid of chances like yourself. But actually, she was really kind, and she sort of gave me a bit of a first break, and she let me send lots of tracks in for films and television. And I got quite a few cuts with her and quite a few syncs with some of my artists with her. And we actually became really good friends. I then ran the New York office and was moved back to the UK. I then left the company, started managing artists on my own and songwriters, setting up co-writes. And then I also got a job with BMG, buying and selling catalogues, the big catalogues for them. Oh, so wow. I sort of got a very kind of all-round knowledge of the industry, doing copyright, doing A&R, doing sync. And buying catalogues. And that's really how it all sort of came together for me. 10 years ago, I came down with ME, which is chronic fatigue syndrome. Overnight, I literally became bedridden. And I had to give it all up. And it was terrible, because literally overnight, I just could no longer move. And I was like that for about 6 months. And then as I sort of gradually started improving, I thought, what can I do with my life? And I started licensing songs for film and television, because that was something that I could do from my bed. And my first client didn't actually know I was bedridden, and sent me a film that they were working on to music supervise, and didn't know that I was bedridden. I did it all from my bed on my laptop.
Incredible.
Oh my God. And then from that, my client then went on to do bigger and bigger and bigger films and become really successful. And thankfully, as I've got better, they've got bigger. And I'm fully recovered now. But it's been it was a long road of about 10 years, really, 8 to 10 years.
Oh, my God. And
anyway, I'm now fully recovered and working full time and working on fantastic projects. So
that's Oh, my God. What an arc. What an incredible journey. This is amazing. Okay, so look at let's pause with Michelle. Rupert, let's see if you can. I want to see if you could double down on this incredible story. How did you get your start? Obviously, both you and Michelle and you're far from ending, but where you are today is probably a world away from where we all started. So tell us about your beginnings.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a world away. And actually, just hearing Michelle's incredible story, some of which I know about Michelle's background and how she navigated through the different areas of the industry, it's fantastic. And kind of made me think as well, what was the landscape when I started? And I have to say, it was probably older than the internet in terms of my career. I think it was just, I mean, obviously it was there, but the late 90s, it was kind of, wasn't really used. And much like Michelle, I mean, I was in a band and I was the world's worst musician and I went from band to band and went DJed and everything, and it didn't pay the rent. So it's a very linear story that's been played out thousands of times around the world. I couldn't pay the rent. I actually very literally needed to pay the rent, so I couldn't wait around for my number one world charts and all of that stuff. So I literally did the next best thing. Everything I knew was music, and I really cared about at that point, apart from soccer, was music. So I hunted around, and fresh out of uni, I got a gig at a small music publisher. And again, much like Michelle, I was making tea and being picked on by the A&R team and all of that good stuff that puts hair on your chest. And it was kind of crazy times. I mean, certainly the offices that I started in, the senior staff were going out 3 or 4 times a week to the pub for 3 or 4 hour lunches. And it was a vastly different world. I started in kind of copyright and publishing as well. So, we were doing kind of copyright registrations on literally on bits of tracing paper. Things like JWF forms where you had to go and file them and it wasn't done on the computer. So it was a really different world. And again, as Michelle said, the sync world was different, especially in London. There weren't really any sync companies, so to speak, or certainly weren't really music supervisors. Things were more organic and licensing was a kind of strange beast. I did get a bit of a break when someone, our office was very near to an editor studio and so an edit suite, and their clients would pop in to see other members of staff, and one day they came in needing music for a National Geographic thing, and I was just kind of sent there because no one else could do it, and kind of sitting in this edit trying to find temp music for this crazy producer who was just kind of basically taking drugs and eating sushi like all day long, which was kind of interesting dynamic to be working in, and I kind of helped him pick out these 10 tracks for this wildlife documentary. And I kind of always loved film anyway. I wanted to be a film producer and all of this kind of thing. So it was nice. I kind of got into it that way. And eventually I went freelance and just trying my luck. And, I was kind of young, dumb and naive, but also all the confidence of youth, and I managed to score a few deals after I left the publishing company I started in, and kind of went from there. I guess my career has been quite cyclical and probably defined by the crash of 2008. I was kind of at a publisher, I went freelance, doing okay, for someone my age, I felt I was doing well, and I was my own boss, which was cool. And then the crash happened, and in 2008, the job started to dry up a bit, and I thought, right, I need to get back into publishing, something a bit more solid for me, a 9-to-5 kind of thing. And I just landed on my feet. I joined a company called Imagen, hired there by someone I work with now, one of my best friends, didn't know then. And so I worked there for 4 or 5 years. I represented some fantastic bands, interacting with people like Tony Smith, obviously, Genesis manager, the formidable Tony Smith, and really learned that side of the business in and out. Ended up running their film and television division over there and for licensing. And that was that. And then,
yeah, is that how you and Michelle know each other?
I don't know how we know each other, Michelle. We might have met when I was at Imagen, maybe 10, 12 years ago.
I've always heard your name. I mean, it's quite a small industry, the music business, so I'm sure it was at gigs and things like that. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just feel like I've known you forever. We probably haven't. Yeah. I don't know.
I think we're all part of the scene. I mean, I'm sure we'll get into it later, but it's a really interesting dynamic. And actually, I mean, right now it's a fascinating time to talk about sync and music supervision, if you're that way inclined, because the world is changing weekly in terms of how things are set up.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, obviously not just because of the technology and the internet, but I think, you know, there's just a whole new set of eyes on syncs and scores and music supervising. So before I let Rose in for her next question, I'm just wondering, I came up through the label side, A&R, and then executive at IRS and on to Sony. And it was always like, you know, A&R, everyone's, oh, that's such a cool gig. But as an A&R guy, it was always like, oh, the music supervisor, that's the rock and roll job. As publishers coming up through the publishing side, was music supervising, it seemed like Michelle was kind of actually caught off guard with this offer to do music supervising. But I'm just wondering if either of you had that in your, you know, in that list of, oh, I'd like to do that, just because it seems like such a fun kind of job. And then you do the job and you realize it's not so much fun, it's more paperwork. But
yeah, I was just going to say exactly that. So when I used to go to these conferences and see all the music supervisors talking about their jobs, like, that's incredible, I want to do that. And I sort of used to look in awe at the supervisors and try and talk to them and get them to hear my artist tracks and things like that. I really believe, like most people do, and in fact, one of my old bosses thought the same thing, that music supervisors get to listen to music all day and just place a track. look at a scene and go, oh, I know, I'll come up with five songs for that scene. And then one of them works and it's great. And that's what I thought it was. It's only when you get into it that you realize that's about a 20th of the job.
Yeah,
and then,
exactly.
And the other 19 or whatever is a lot of hard work, a lot of slog, a lot of paperwork, a lot of legal. And although it's a great job, it's definitely not what it's perceived, I think, from outsiders. What do you think, Rue?
I totally agree. And it's one of those things. Also, I'd add to that list potentially a bedroom psychologist as well. You know, when you're like a scene of the trash compactor in Star Wars, and you're holding two walls apart from each other. And, you know, you've got to, as Michelle says, there's 20% of it is creative, but yeah. I've terrorized certainly audiences around the world, you know, sitting panels when they, oh, I really want to be a music supervisor. And you tell them the reality.
Like, no, you
it
don't.
It doesn't often. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like you've got to organize stuff and be on top of it. And I think that's a discipline that we definitely all learn. But I think also there's the whole thing of protecting budgets with producers in your ear and then directors who just do not care about the producers or the budget or you or anything. They want what they want. They've all got the best record collections in the world as well.
So I'd love from either one of you, if you guys have a story about, you know, have you been caught between the director and producer, the director and editor? Where do you end up? I mean, how, you know, that's happened to me before. It's a very rough situation to be in the middle, but how do you appease those three kind of perspectives? Because you are, as the music supervisor, firmly in the middle.
I don't know. I mean, just quickly. I mean, I guess it's very, very difficult because the producer obviously holds the keys to the kingdom in terms of the money. But they're very. I mean, I don't know about you, Michelle. In my experience, you don't really get that many creative producers. You do. I think at a kind of higher budgets, like people that have raised bigger money for films. Generally, they're more experienced. You know, blah blah blah. And they're probably more of a creative. I'd say maybe 20% of my clients, in terms of producers, are more creative, so they're there and they do get it. But often you've got people that are desperately trying to protect their own budgets and protect departments. The famous adage of, you know, music is always thought of last. I mean, I also run a score funding company and we commission scores, and you know that even with that, you see what some of the investment that you put into a film, where it's actually taken, they try and take it away from the composers, and it's crazy. It's crazy, actually. I don't know if any of that rings true for you, Michelle, but yeah, it's really, it can be a tough gig because you have to keep everyone happy. you know, you have to be respectful of everyone's position. So it's tricky.
No, I've definitely been in positions, particularly, you know, on films that have been going for several years. And by the end of it, by the time I get on board, the producers and directors hate each other. Everyone's fallen out. There's no money left. They have a different vision. The director has a totally different vision for what the producer wants. The producer wants to have a soundtrack that's going to sell and make money and, you know, have sort of, you know, a pop act on it that's going to appeal to 14-year-old kids. And then the director wants to keep it cool and wants the kind of soundtrack that's going to be a bit under the radar and edgy and different. And it is quite hard that, you know, you definitely do have to be, like we said, a bit of a psychologist and move between everybody and appease everybody. There's usually ways around it, but it can take a bit of, you know, sleepless nights and really kind of thinking about how you can navigate the situation.
I'm always curious, you know, as a producer, when we get our first budgets, I always look at the music line and it always seems very thin to me, because if you've been at this long enough, you understand that music is not cheap, or as you've both pointed out, the music that directors want or that producers want is not cheap. How soon, if you had your, and I'm asking you and Rupert then as well, how soon do you want to get involved in a project? What is the best time for you to come in a project so that the music part of it and the integrity of the music can be protected in a film?
So, Rose, one of the reasons why I really enjoy and want to do sort of shows like this or go to panels or speak to film schools and everything is to try and get it into directors and producers' heads that please talk to us at the beginning of the project. The number of times I've come on board to a project, in fact, it happened last week with a project where, you know, I was given a music budget and it's so, so small, and they have just completely unrealistic, the client has unrealistic expectations of what they can have for the money. It's always much easier to get money when you're raising funds and everything as a producer, and to get the money at the beginning than try and get the money after the production has been filmed. So I always say, please talk to supervisors and get a realistic budget up front, and it will make everybody's life a lot easier moving forward.
And why do they do that to us, Michelle? I don't understand. Why do they do that to themselves? It's like, okay, there's a line item for catering, for hair, for makeup.
Yeah, it's the last place you should be prepping on.
And it's truly the one element that can really make or break a film.
Yeah. And here's another thing. What's happening in the business a lot is independent producers get approached by these third-party people who want to pre-buy the rights to the soundtracks. And they're really paltry sums, but the producers are so desperate to make up for what they're lacking that they take these deals. And this is, for me, these guys are like carpetbaggers. They come in and they take music scores for nothing, essentially. And then when you go to roll out your film, you're eliminating a potential potential revenue stream that you could have had if you kept the music rights in your possession.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that, Rupert?
Well, it's interesting. And, you know, because I also, as I said, I run a school funding company. I often find myself fighting. And listen, not to you know, come over as the great hope and Superman of that world. But you're right, there are the carpetbaggers out there. There are, I can think of several companies, which I'm not going to name, that do exactly that. And they will take advantage of the fact that the director, the producer rather, would need any money they can get in. We actually now have in our contracts, because don't forget, on the score funding side of things, you are, as you pointed out, you own the rights, the producers and the film owns the rights. Apart from the writer's share, which goes back to the composer, the rights start with the film because they are commissioning the piece. So there are companies like mine and others, but we all are very, very different. So, for example, we write into our contracts that the money that we are putting forward to the production has to go to the composer and for the use of the score, for example. And we actually base what we invest on certain internal algorithms that we're quite proud of and we think are very different. So for us, we're always taking care of the composer. We're always making sure that the film has the right amount of musical investment into it so that they can't go off and kind of put it into different departments. So it's a really difficult one. I mean, I think going back to the original question as well, often, you know, you might get onto a film and they've written, you know, a Rolling Stones track into four different parts of the script, and the director has to have those tracks no matter what. You know? And it's that's a moment when, yeah, you can. I mean, I got a call today, literally today, from a friend, a producer, who does a lot of kind of feature documentaries. And he said to me, look, this other new documentary, it's coming out, it's coming up, it's going to be great. I need to send you the track list we're looking at, so you can sense check it and you can say to me, hey, look, Jason, you know what, just stay away from that Sex Pistols song or whatever it is.
Right.
And that has come from a 10-year relationship with this guy, and he understands the game, but you know, as you do, Rosie, as well, you know. But it's that is still rare to a degree, you know, given the kind of ubiquity and certainly Michelle and the projects that she works on, you know, she sees a lot of different kinds of producers, and they all have different sweet spots.
We you know, it's funny because years ago when I was teaching a graduate film course at Tisch, NYU Tisch here in New York, we would talk about this, and I always gave the example of Dirty Dancing. And Dirty Dancing was financed by a film fund, was called the Great American Film Fund. And they were going to do five films. And so nobody remembers the names of the other four films. And Dirty Dancing made so much money. But what most people don't know is that the soundtrack for Dirty Dancing made and still makes even more than the film did. And those rights, so the investors not only got paid back off of the profits of the film, but they got paid back off of the profits of the music in the film. You know, these are things that you're cutting the possibility of these things happening by selling out too early. You know, if you want a Stones track, probably only Marty Scorsese can keep affording putting Stones music in his movies, right? But yeah, I mean, and then a lot of, because I work with a lot of emerging directors as well, emerging directors have a very clear idea of what they want, but they can't afford it most of the times. So, you know.
I think, Rose, I will make it, because I come from, as Rhee does, we come from publishing backgrounds and artist management and writer management. Of course, I'm always going to look after the producer who is now my client and the director, and I'm always going to get the best deal for them where I can. And because of my relationships with managers and with publishers, I can often get songs for less than maybe other people who don't have those relationships do. But it is my life's work to try and educate filmmakers on music rights and the value of music, because in my opinion, a bad film could be made good by good music, and a good film can be made bad by bad music.
Yeah. Where do you stand in creating original music for a film rather than just licensing music that exists? And then if you want a certain song, where does it come down when you don't have the money for the original and you do a cover? How do you approach, both of you chime in on this, how do you approach those challenges?
It's funny because I've been, I'm sure you haven't, shown I've had a lot of calls with producers that have said, look, that's a great idea, you know, we'll do this great cover of the song. You know, 95% of the time, yes, it's about budget rather than there being a cool cover of the song. I mean, I think it's definitely a special skill set within the music, I'd say. Was interested in what Michelle thought, but I'd say that, you know, on camera stuff and recording and re-recording covers, for example, for tracks, are all writing bespoke end credit tracks. And that's definitely a niche skill within the music supervisor basket or your armory. I think if you can navigate that kind of thing, it's really good for you as a supervisor. It can be tricky because, you know, you've got kind of one, you know, you've got one shot sometimes to get these things right. And also you've got an eye on budget there as well. You know, even if you're recording a cover because it's going to be cheaper. I remember working with a now relatively famous actress. I spent a day in the studio with Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones. It was just as that show was like in its first season. And obviously it was big, but she wasn't who, you know, has the stature of what she is today. And she was singing a song in this film on stage. She was playing someone in a band in this film. And she came in to record a cover of a studio, actually using Metropolis Studio before I went over to run the supervision of Metropolis Studios. And we went in there and she came in. And we were under a lot of pressure that day because the budget, it was an indie film, the budget wasn't great. And we had one day and that was it. And I had no idea. She said she could sing, but you know what? She came in and she did it in one take. She was an incredible singer. Like,
I thought you were going to give us a horror story. That's amazing.
No, I couldn't possibly do that. But no, it was one of those. She came in. I said to my wife, I'm spending the day in the studio. Really, like, amazing. And she would come calling me, and she just nailed it. And but that's great because it just went according to plan, totally pro. But often, you know, it depends who you're getting to cover these songs. You know, it could be anyone, and then the budget is squeezed. So I definitely think it's a pressure situation when you do that, and you have to be really on top of it. You know?
Yeah, I agree, really, because I mean, I've actually been quite lucky with doing covers, and I think my publishing, I don't know about you, but my publishing background has really helped me with that, to work out who, you know, which vocalist can do certain songs, because you might be an actor or somebody with an amazing voice, but you might not be right for a particular style of song. So I think that's been quite useful, my background there. I work a lot with my namesake, Marius De Vries. He goes by MDV1 and I go by MDV2. We're not related, but I respect him 1,000,000%. He's a good friend of mine. We used to live very near each other. And I've been lucky enough to work with him on several films. So for those who don't know Marius, he's basically the music director for things like Moulin Rouge, Romeo and Juliet, La La Land. He's just done this fantastic film called Coda. And he is just without a doubt the most professional, amazing person that you could ever wish to work with. And we've worked on several films together. And one was a really fun film directed by a friend of ours called Stefan Elliott, who did Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, if you know that film. And the film we did was called Easy Virtue. And it was a sort of take on Noel Coward's Easy Virtue. And Stefan wanted us to do kind of crazy covers of like Noel Coward songs and also some modern songs like Sex Bomb by the Tom Jones song and make them into a kind of 1930s vibe. And that was probably one of the most fun projects I've ever worked on. Because we got together, like we kind of auditioned a jazz band, we got together musicians, we went in and rehearsed for a week, and then we went into the studio and recorded these songs. And it was just absolutely amazing. But, you know, I'm lucky because I was working with Marius, who I trust 100%. Like, I know everything he turns his hand to is going to be brilliant. So, you know, if it's a sort of composer that isn't used to working with covers and that kind of thing and doesn't have a track record, I would be a bit more nervous about putting a lot of budget into something like that, I think.
Yeah. Do you think that people are still going for big scores? I mean, you know, back in the day, remember when films used to have, you know, the overtures and before the films even started? And I mean, you know, where you could breathe in a score. We don't seem to have that much of a luxury with that anymore.
I'm trying to think about that because I do think that there's some incredible scores out there, and there are some, like, that when the money's put into scores, they're just on. I don't know about you, Rio. I just think they're getting more and more interesting as time goes on. I mean, you know, you look at people like Johnny Greenwood, you look at people I mean, there's just really interesting, and a lot of the new electronic scores. I mean, when I started music supervising 10 years ago, most of the scores were still classical. And a couple of my directors were like, I want to go electronic. And we actually struggled to find people, you know, and we were really testing and trying people out. And every temp score was drive, you know, any electronic was drive. And of course, now there's so many amazing electronic guys all doing incredible scores. So for me, it's just changed. So you maybe don't have the huge budgets to do these massive things. But I think scores are really interesting these days.
I definitely agree. I mean, you could probably chart kind of trends and styles within the score world. And going back to really started, 20s and 30s, you know, when those movies came to life in terms of sound, you know, if you go back to the 90s, I think there was this glut, wasn't there? It was massive scores, usually in Kevin Costner films that were just epic and, you know, really, like, some of them just beautiful and stood the test of time. I think there was a time when you'd go around to people's houses when I was younger and they would all have one CD of a score in their CD rack, and it was always Braveheart, you know, and like these kind of like iconic moments, but they were all really beautiful. But also, you could describe them as quite self-indulgent. And I think like Michelle and Rose make a really good point, which is, you know, people's attitude to what scores are now are changing, and it does catch like wildfire, because even, you know, producers and directors that may not know score world that well, they'll definitely be influenced by other things that they're hearing. And the rise of all those musicians that are now, you know, coming from successful bands and becoming passionate score composers, it's amazing, because it just brings this whole range. I mean, I just worked on a film last year called Mothering Sunday, which I think isn't going to come out in the States quite soon. But, you know, it's Olivia Colman, it's a period drama, Colin Firth, lovely. And it was, the score was done by one of MAC3.
Oh, wow. You
know, absolutely mad. And it's a beautiful, shimmering 1920s, you know, ethereal score. I think it's changing for the better. I definitely think.
But even when we do period films right now, everybody wants to make them feel, even though their period, wants to make them feel contemporary. So having people who are in the world of contemporary music and using classical themes mixed with a more contemporary feel gets you something very interesting in many cases.
Yeah, I agree. I'm looking always for artists who score, as well as obviously more traditional composers that have come up through the traditional composing route. I don't know. I've always find that the ones that, I mean, obviously there's always exception to this, but the artists who score are coming from the guitar backgrounds, the bass backgrounds, the drumming backgrounds, rather than the singing backgrounds, in my opinion. Not always 100% that's true, but whenever I've worked with sort of singers who then want to get into scoring for film, they're so used to being the front people and them, you know, this is what I've written. This is, you know, they're not as flexible as, say, an artist who's maybe a drummer or a bass player or a guitarist who's used to being in the background a little bit. I always find that they tend to work better with directors and producers. Personally, I don't know about you, Ray. Did you find that at all?
Yeah, I do. I think you're right. And again, it just goes back to the kind of, they are coming from a very, very, very different background. And, you know, Michelle and I, you know, I know we both know a lot of people in that world and in that position. And, you know, it can take a while, because I think also, like, scoring to pictures is a big, big deal. Like, you know, that it's a massive skill, and it's difficult, and it's something that you kind of have to learn on the job, no matter how well trained you are. And I think, it seems to me, and I might be wrong, just in my experience, it seems to me that kind of classically trained composers probably took to the skill set of scoring to picture a little more freely, maybe. But conversely, you know, these modern musicians you know, they all, they're all used to work, working with edits and visual media and all of that. And so the world is open. Because, you know, a few years ago, it was, you know, as Michelle said, it was kind of Johnny Greenwood, John Murphy, and Fatboy Slim, who just changed genre rather than got into scoring, you know, and now a lot of people are doing it. It's great. It's great. I think it's a really fertile moment in the score world, you know.
I wanted to ask you, if I could, you know, what's it like working as a music supervisor, you know, in the context of the different varieties of work that you'll have been involved with, you know, from documentaries to miniseries to TV programs, you know, is there much difference between each of the different genres, I guess?
So for me, Rue may have a different story. Films often take over much longer time. There's more preparation, depending on budget, of course. There's usually more time for the composer put aside. We can really kind of be talking early on and really kind of really getting the tone perfect and really spending time on that. TV is very quick turnaround. I'll give you an example. I worked on a show last year, which we had a week per episode to turn it around, and there was 80 minutes of music per episode, and that included turning around the score, choosing and licensing 10 tracks per episode. And that was crazy, to be honest. Won't lie and say that was the hardest job I've ever done. And at one point, myself and various other people, we all thought we were having a stroke or nervous breakdowns or something. And, you know, I can laugh about it now. But it's actually, you know, it is crazy in those kind of situations. It's often the edit overruns on TV shows, and of course, it's then the music that gets pushed back. So we were under a lot of pressure, and I don't think that's good for the production, and I don't think that's good for, you know, there's no way. And by the way, I had a composer who was brilliant. But he will not say that that's his best score, because how can you turn around that amount of music when you're writing 10 cues a day? Mm-hmm. So I always really try and bang it into clients, like, just give us a little bit more time on these things and we will, we always come through and we always make it work. But is it something that you really want to be doing when it's those kind of deadlines, you know, when you're working? We were working 20-hour days with 7 days a week. And it's great, but things were not going to be as good as when you've got time and you can really curate things and bring things together. And you know, you can tell when things are rushed and when they're not at the end of the day, I think. So TV is definitely usually a bit more rushed in my experience. And film is usually a bit more curated and a bit, you know, you can really get in and dig down deep and really get creative, I think. Not always, obviously. And, you know, some TV shows are, you know, I work on a great show called The Catcher, which is really well organised. There's a lot of time for the score, a lot of time for licensing tracks. That's just brilliantly done. And it shows, because the show is brilliant. Yeah.
Totally agree. And I think about TV is like, it's kind of like, I've found it like, you know, sometimes you're lucky enough to go to a country and you really enjoy it when you're there, but it's a struggle, you know, and you're kind of like, I love that, and I'm glad I went there once and I never go there again. The experience is so good. I mean, for me, I do more films than TV, but we do a lot of telly. We've done an Apple TV series and Amazon and Netflix we're working with, you know, so we are in that world, but it's hardcore, and it's something I kind of tend to enjoy the final result rather than the actual day-to-day of it. I mean, I did work in a BBC animated series where the music, there was a weekly music delivery, as Michelle's describing, but in this case, the show was running, it was live, it was going on, there were like 52 episodes. So you were working to a deadline where the show was going to go out, like it was going to go out with the music you were having to create, so you just had this constantly moving deadline. Certainly for that, there's no way I could have worked on another project alongside. It was all consumed. It's terrible, actually, but, you know, you kind of did it in the end because you have to. Pressure can be a good incentive, you know?
Yeah, I think that show I was telling you about that I worked on, it was crazy, and I was so scared when it came out to watch it. I can't watch it. Then about 6 months later, I watch it, and actually, it turned out great. And I was like, wow, that actually really worked. But the pressure was so intense, you know.
Mm. Well, going back to the film you spoke about earlier on, Easy Virtue, we actually have a clip of when the going gets tough, if you want to hear it. Let's spin it, Manfredo.
Yes.
It's been many years since I've heard this. I can't wait to hear it. This was like the most fun session ever.
I've got something to tell you.
Brilliant.
I got something to say.
I'm all ears.
I'm gonna put these wheels in motion. And let nothing stand in my way.
What a cool version.
Yeah. So that was so cool.
That
was the end credit, and it was Jessica Biel on vocals and Colin Firth as well. And
That's so hard to believe. I don't believe it.
And we had so much fun in the studio, and we got this band together, and I don't know if you have the trumpet and the trombone in that, but honestly, these guys were extraordinary. Like, they were just amazing. And we just stayed up. We actually stayed in the studio, and we lived in the studio for about 10 days, and we were all living in like pajamas, and we had sleeping bags, and because we were just trying to get it all done in time. And everybody was together, the whole band, and lots of red wine was consumed, and it was just absolutely, that was just one of my most favorite projects.
Well, I was all ears listening to it.
Hey, we have to really hold on to those moments, because like you were saying earlier, Michelle, you know, that there's your 20% right there. I think that's like 4 years of your 20%, right? Yeah. In that one recording session.
You're so right. Every time I'm tearing my hair out, going, oh my God, why do I do this job? I need to listen to that album in the future.
So a subject that we don't a lot in our discussions is how to maintain a healthy work and life balance in this business. I mean, when we're working, we don't work 9-to-5 jobs. This is a very stressful industry, getting even more stressful by the second. And when you're doing music supervision, sometimes you're doing more than one project at the same time. I mean, how do you balance all of the long hours, and where do you draw the line between me time and work time? Do you have any, both of you, do you have any special strategies that have worked for you?
It's really tough, isn't it, Michelle? I mean, it's and because, again, I know Michelle, we work across different genres, and as we've been saying, so the rhythms are different. But for me, definitely, I also work a lot on West Coast time, you know, on LA time. And it's tricky, you know, especially like, you know, got a daughter, and, you know, school runs and that. I mean, for me, I try and just keep abreast of the projects that I need to. I try and do as much in advance as I can. And you know what? I'll turn my phone off for an hour or something, make sure I can. I'll go for a bike ride, and I'll try and do something like that every day, just carve out. I think because we are effectively our own bosses, and, you know, it's not, as you say, Rosen, it's not the 9-to-5, you know. I think if you're clever, you can then find that hour, 2 hours to go and do stuff. I mean, personally, I used to get a lot more stressed in this job when I started to do it. It takes a lot for me to get kind of wound up in the ways I used to. You know, I'd be up in the middle of the night, I can't clear that track, and what's going on? And there's only 6 weeks left. And, you know, and I'm like, now, like, you know, there's a lot of horror in our job.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, movies help people, but that's also put it into perspective. So I think you just got to keep a dialogue with yourself, keep talking, not let the pressure get to you. It's, yeah. You know, there's the whole bedroom psychology as well. So
Yeah. What about you, Michelle?
I definitely will say hands up that I'm a perfectionist, and that probably has helped me in my career, which is why I do get sort of clients coming back again and again to me. And I really make sure that I, you know, cross the T's and dot the I's and that sort of thing. as all supervisors have to do, you know, otherwise we wouldn't be supervisors. I definitely struggled with it a lot, and especially having to start my career all over again. I definitely priced myself too low at the beginning, and I didn't want to say no to jobs. Every job that came in, I took, whether it was good or bad one. I took on a counsellor who's been amazing with me, I'll be honest and say that, because I think it's really important for a lot of people. I think it's very difficult to say no to jobs when you're freelance. You want to take everything on, and then you end up just in a terrible sort of, you know, and you want to give 110% to every project. And the only person that loses out is yourself. Nobody else does. Your clients still get 110%. But you end up not eating, not sleeping. Like Rhys said, especially at the beginning, oh my God, the first time I thought I couldn't clear a song, you know, just couldn't sleep. Yeah, the end of the world. And now it's like, okay, now, you know what? Didn't happen. Here's five other choices, you know. And it's, you learn on the job and you realize. And actually, I worked for this fantastic company called Aardman, which is with Shaun the Sheep. And they're just completely professional. And I remember, I will say that I very rarely make mistakes. And I did make a mistake on a job for them. And I just couldn't have been more stressed and more upset about it. And when I spoke to the main producer, he said, hey, these things happen. We all do it, you know. And that was a massive, massive lesson to me, because I really, really thought my world had ended. So I try and take time. I mean, actually, funny enough, Rue and I worked recently together, and I saw how Rue was taking a little, you know, was able to manage his days. And I've learned quite a lot from you, Rue, actually, on that, because I think as well, it's just, it is difficult when you work for yourself and you always want to be available. And I once worked for a guy in the music business that said, if you don't return my emails within 15 minutes, three times in a row, you're fired.
Oh, wow.
And he used to send emails at 11 o'clock at night and, you know, 6 in the morning. And you were just always completely stressed. And I just think that's the wrong way to get the best out of people.
Our industry seems to attract people who have very little respect for the time of others, depending on what their position is. From the producer point of view, we suffer from a lot of the creatives, the talent. Yeah. Where they'll call you in the middle of the night, and you always like regret taking those calls, because they don't often end well.
No,
because you shouldn't be talking at that time of night in the middle of when you're supposed to be sleeping, and it does really get to you.
I think it's very easy to make ourselves too available in mm-hmm. in this industry. And we all do it. I mean, it's not just music supervisors. I mean, producers are some of the most stressed people. You know, I mean, they are just constantly having to be available for everybody and do everything. Yeah. Boundaries is a big thing, learning boundaries. And I struggle with that, you know?
Yeah.
But you
wear a lot of hats no matter what you're doing in this business. And it could be like a grip, but you know, if at some point, you know, if people are a little bit unbalanced, and we kind of attract those kind of people in the business, but you know, all of a sudden you become psychiatrist, mentor. I mean, you become everything to these people in the midst of a production. It's very bizarre behavior in a lot of cases, but it's how you have to get through each day. And I think what Rupert said was right. The longer you've been at it, the calmer you become, and the more able you are perhaps to pivot when you need. But when you first start out, everything becomes a crisis, because that's what it seems like, you know?
Yeah,
absolutely. And do you know what? I think also with that, with the experience, which is great, you know, I think you learn, well, obviously you learn a lot, but you learn about what, you learn to almost second guess what someone else's priorities and importance are. And I think it's important, not even with that, also in life, you know, someone might have a different attitude to something that is stressing them out, and then they might put it on you. And you kind of get a sense. I mean, ironically, it doesn't happen a lot, but ironically, occasionally, I'll be working with a producer who I know I'm far more experienced than they are. Like, it might be their second film, and I've probably sat through 70 you know, with finance meetings. I understand how films are financed. I mean, I produce a little bit as well myself. You know, and I'm thinking that this person is worrying about this, and they're worrying unnecessarily. But obviously, you've got to be respectful of that. Like, it's their reality and their truth and their life. And it's their journey, and they're doing all of that. And it's about kind of being respectful and saying, look, you know, we can all be calm here. This has to move into this area for this to happen. It's a strange dynamic. And I guess that happened all over a film. You know, you're going to get sparkies and DOPs who've been doing it for 50 years, and then they've got some young buck director in their first feature. Like, everyone has different levels of experience.
Yeah, and everybody's freaking out. You have to be the grown-up in the room. Yeah, somebody needs to.
Well, I lots of people in my life would laugh if I was pretending to be the grown-up. I definitely aspire to that.
Yeah.
I definitely like to be the person, though. I like to say to clients, look, if you've got all other stuff going on that's just horrific to deal with, trust me, I will make the music work. And that's kind of what I try and do, is just to, my job is to say to the directors and producers, I promise you it will be okay music-wise, you know? You can just trust me that you won't end up in lawsuits, you won't end up with this, you won't end up with that, and the music will be good. And that's what I try and do, to take the pressure off those guys, because, you know, producers are really, really stressed.
Oh, that should be on your website, Michelle. That was beautiful.
Yeah. You know, the music industry and the process of music supervision has changed over the years, obviously due to technology and advancements and stuff. And, you know, more recently, obviously, the ability to attend live music events has become more challenging, certainly over the last 2 years. You know, where are you sourcing your catalogue from for current and future films, bearing that in mind?
From my point of view, I guess it's a mixture of old and new. I mean, I think like anyone, even music fans, you know, your platform of choice, you know, which could be, you know, whatever it might be, you know, you can go down to radicals, can't you? And, you know, musicians like this and all of that. And you can do that for pleasure. And also, yes, certainly from a music supervision point of view, I do that. I also think, and I'd be interested to hear Michelle's statements, but it also depends on the creative brief that you're looking at, the kind of film or TV show that you're working in. You know, and again, the famous alluded to narrative, we've all been going, you know, if the director wants these six tracks, you're not going to have any need to search for anything, because if you can afford them, you're going to go and fill those tracks. But I think for me, I still will brief out specifically to companies I need to, or I think that they will have particular styles or genres that I need globally. I do my own searches. You know, it's an odd thing. I mean, I've even had to, like, we did this Apple TV show last year, and it was, a lot of it was based in South America, and it was, you know, I was on Facebook trying to find, like, Peruvian electronica labels, you know, because they just didn't have a website. I mean, it was insane. But that's the thing, you're absolutely right. That's the cool part of the
job. Yeah. That's the fun bit. I agree. Yeah. That's the fun bit of the job. Yeah.
Yeah. This is what I signed up for.
Yeah, I agree. It's the research that I absolutely love when I'm working on a project and they say, oh, we're looking for Peruvian music for the 60s. It's like, yay, I'm on it. You know, it's so much fun to find that kind of stuff out.
And not only is it fun to, like, get turned on to, like, these new genres and pockets of music that we might have somehow not even known existed, but when you actually reach out to those artists, like, that moment just must feel so good for this, you know, obscure artist in Brazil. Be like, yeah, I'd be happy to license my music. You must have, like, really positive vibes coming through those emails.
Sometimes they have to.
They want more money.
Yeah, they got, like, I recently worked on a project where it was literally like that. It was a Brazilian DJ that's never had, you know, he's had, like, kind
had
of
anything.
And I'm like, I finally literally tracked him down by contacting a friend of mine who's a promoter, DJ promoter in Chile, and asking him if he knew this guy. And then he contacted friends, and they basically, oh yeah, like, he's a DJ in our village. So they knocked on his door and they found him. And then I said to the guy, I'm giving you like £5,000 for this track. And he's like, I want
$100,000.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah, America comes calling, or England comes calling.
And he thought I was ripping him off, and I'm like, I'm not. This is a really good thing.
Well, this, you know, I think that's funny because this is part of the problem. There is, like we always say on the show, we're pulling the curtain back on sinks because there is, you know, there was this time where, you know, there was huge, and I, you know, look, the big studio is still, there is money there, but they were paying a lot of money for these certain songs because I think like there was a stigma for, you know, commercial placement of music, you know, up until recently. It was like, you know, even like the Doors famously, you know, Jim Morrison was pissed because they put in that car commercial or whatever. But now it's like Donovan says, he has this line, he goes, I'm not selling out, I'm selling in. And now there's almost a bigger acceptance. And I think, you know, it has affected, you know, the numbers that, that, you know, we're able to present for, you know, master and publishing rights.
Yeah, I agree. Don't you, Rue? I mean, first of all, there's a lot more productions needing music these days. So, you know, I think, so that's one thing. But also, you know, artists like Beatles and stuff have become more amenable to syncs, you know, providing it's the right sync. I mean, Bruce Springsteen is wonderful. Like, I've synced quite a few of his songs, but when you go to him, you really have to send a sort of 5-page report on how the sync's going to be used, what the marketing budget is of the program. You have to, you know, and then he agrees to do it. And that's because he really cares about his catalog.
I wonder if you'll see a difference now, you know, now that he and Dylan and Neil Diamond, everybody's selling their catalog. I wonder if it's going to be easier for you to access or more expensive.
I don't know. Probably. Yeah. Easier. I don't know. I don't know.
It's a really difficult one. I mean, there's one particular major who I'm not going to name. They were actually swallowed up by the company a year ago, but they were always, they had kind of one, they had a big batch of iconic songs, but like, you know, they had one song by a particular band and one song by another, and they always charged too much, like ridiculous amounts of money. So these songs, which were beautiful and world famous, would never ever get used unless it was on the biggest productions. And it wasn't because the estates were particularly fussy in any direction. It was more that they just had this internal price point structure, and it's what they did. They weren't proactive in kind of putting those prices down. Then obviously when this company got sold, and it's kind of ubiquitous story for the ages, isn't it, really, in music publishing? But as soon as that company got sold, they immediately dropped the price point on these kind of heritage gems, you know. And lo and behold, they, you know, they would have made more money in 6 months than they made in 3 years at the old price point. So I still think there's definitely companies that say, you know, over a, well, two bottles of wine, me and Michelle could sit there and probably say, yeah, well, we've had similar experiences with them globally, you know, where they're going to be, what they're going to do, how they're going to price things. But I think, you know, it's difficult. Also, I don't know how far down this rabbit hole we want to go, but, you know, the streamers is now like a big problem, because obviously publishing revenues from certain streamers are not great. You know, it's akin to kind of the whole Spotify thing. And ultimately, of course, then the rights holders are going to put zeros onto what they're quoting, because their artists are not going to see any back end from this usage, which was always the sweetener. So it's changing all the time, and how people supervise as well. And there are lots of in-house supervisors now as well, you know. Me and Michelle are obviously fiercely independent, so it's definitely a changing landscape, that for sure.
Oh my God, guys, what an incredible conversation. I just got a message. We're creeping up on an hour, but I think as final questions for both you, Rue, and Michelle, can you tell us what your current projects you're working on now? Michelle, do you want to go first?
I don't know if I can mention Mary's Monster.
Please, yes, mention, you better tell us some updates on this one. I think this is a special project.
So without being funny, and obviously because Rose is on the call, but this is so not, I am so excited about this project. Because not only is the script absolutely amazing, brilliant, there's some really great people involved, and I just have a feeling this is just going to be amazing. I mean, I really do. And it's like, to the point where I'm just like contacting Rose and the other producer Heather all the time. What's going on? I really am excited about this one. And I just have a feeling that we're going to be just making the most incredible soundtrack. I mean, watch the space. But I'm looking for, I suppose what we're looking for, sorry, is that we really want to make this an interesting, cool thing. And we're looking for edgy, iconic artists of the future, if that makes sense. With yeah. obviously mixing it with edgy, iconic artists from the past, perhaps. You know, we're still yeah. in discussions about it, but this is a really, really, really exciting project. And I mean, think about sort of your Nick Caves of the future, your, you know, really interesting, cool people that really can tell stories in their, in the way that they write their lyrics, and people that can really say something and have something to say. I think that's what we're looking for that one.
Yeah.
Well, you're setting the bar high.
But isn't it funny, Michelle and you know, how many actors are also becoming musicians. I find that fascinating. And all of them go off between gigs and they go off with their bands. It's so bizarre. And I know like dozens of actors who are now like have their own bands and doing music as well, which I find interesting.
I think, Rose, I've thought about this a lot, and it's because that I bet you they're usually singers, right? When they have their own bands. And basically, singers and actors are frontmen. You've got to have a certain chutzpah, and I'm out there to put yourself in front of people. You know, like a drummer.
You're doing movies, right?
Yeah. I mean, a drummer, my husband's a drummer, and he wouldn't be an actor because he's behind the... He chose to be a drummer because he's behind the scenes, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's definitely that people are entertainers, I think, you know?
Yeah.
When they're singers and actors. Right.
They're on stage.
Rather than necessarily being musicians, if that makes sense.
Incredible. What amazing projects.
This is Kevin. I did have one quick question as a filmmaker. Because, you know, I more than often have an idea of the sound that I'm looking for, but it does change according to what's presented. So my question is, what are some of the challenges you maybe have had on both sides, maybe with a filmmaker that's trying to get some particular kind of music and or an artist that maybe is resisting giving up some of their music?
Wow, that's a really, really, really good question. From my point of view, I think I totally see where you're coming from with that, because of course, like number one, your mind, you know, we never know what we're going to be sent. So you might view one of your scenes, which might change what you originally thought you wanted on that scene in your mind. You look at brushes and that's changed it. Or you might get sent a load of music that makes you think about a scene that you weren't thinking of in that way before. You go, oh my God, you know, that's that. I think there's probably a fine line. I maybe shouldn't say this, but I think there's a fine line of being driven insane as a music supervisor by, you know, whereby it's great if a director changes their mind and they have different things. Sometimes that can be a blessing, you know, and all of that. Other times, obviously, if the ideas are chopping and changing like every other day, then that can become problematic. I think on the flip side, I mean, I've certainly more in advertising, I've seen like back in the day when I was working, you know, for trying to put syncs out when I was representing catalogs. I've seen artists say no to certain brands, you know, that kind of stuff happens a lot. The context of films, it doesn't happen so much. It can be a money thing, obviously. I mean, I've worked in a film recently where they came to me and they said, look, we've already done the deal on these four songs and everyone's given us their songs for free. And I was kind of like, okay.
You know, oh my gosh. Like,
yeah, really, like four tracks, and I was kind of like, oh no, you know, that's not cool, because I know what this movie costs, you know, so I know you could have paid for those songs somewhere, but the artists had already signed up to it, and they were all really happy, and I thought those days gone, you know, I thought those days of the kind of the BS line of, hey, it's red exposure, you know, that's awful, you know, that kind of, it shouldn't happen, people need to be paid, but I think, yeah, it's a really interesting question. It goes back to what we were saying about the bedroom psychology. We're there to deliver for the filmmaker, for you. You know, we're there to make your vision come to life. So we have to roll with the punches, you know.
I obviously come from a background of managing and publishing and working in studios. I know what goes into writing a song. and how many songs have to be written before a hit actually, you know, I know that the writers have to pay for plane fares and train fares and all of that kind of stuff. And it's not even necessarily the main artist who's, you know, who can go on tour and make a lot of money from a song. Often the songwriters, you know, they might have written a third of a song and have to have paid a plane fare to LA, stayed in a hotel for 3 weeks to write a third of a song, you know? And for me, I really struggle with people that think that songs should be used for free and for exposure. I love to find new artists and use them in productions, but I'll always pay them and I'll always stress to the producers and the directors, like, you know, even if we just give them 500 quid, you know, some kid off the street that's writing a song, let's give them some money, because it's really important that they understand the value of music and everybody understands that that money has been put into that. They've had to buy equipment, they've had to, you know, all of this kind of stuff. So it's really important that that happens. With regards to artists saying no, I've had a few on projects, and sometimes it's a case of literally, I mean, I have actually sat outside an artist's house one night and waited for them to come back and said, and kind of cornered them and said, look, you don't understand this project. And then they've said, okay, fine, I'll give you the rights. Other times I work on a lot of sports films, so, and a lot of football films. Football's very, very, very tribal in the UK. So I've had lots of no's when I've worked on Man United films. And, you know, I think it was Massive Attack. There was a girl that wrote a third of a Massive Attack song who said, F you, Michelle De Vries, I've never carried my song, I'm the biggest Man City fan in the world.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, but this is great. This is great. Amazing information for, you know, filmmakers, and I'm thinking more in indie filmmakers that may have an idea that they want a song and, you know, they wouldn't even consider trying. And so the information that you all have given really does open it up for, on the independent filmmaker side, the notion that you should at least try to get the music that you want.
Yeah, so from an indie film point of view, can I just say that I've worked on indie films. So iBoy was one of those ones that we didn't have a massive budget, but I wrote, and so did the director, we wrote all of the artists on there, and some of them were really cool artists, you know, and we really didn't have the biggest budget in the world. And we explained the film, we explained what we wanted to achieve, we explained the scenes, we sent them scenes, and we got people to agree to give us songs for much less than they would normally do. My husband, as I say, you know, he's in a big band in the UK called Blur, and they're always willing to give up-and-coming directors and producers some of their songs, maybe not song two, but, you know, some of their songs for less money, because they want to encourage people, up and coming producers, to you know, in their careers. But, you know, there might be terms attached, so maybe you can only use a song for 5 years, or, you know, or whatever. A lot of it's to do with the budget. If you really, really believe and it's a passionate project and the film is good, you will find that artists will often talk to you about it and will allow you to use their music, even if they're quite big songs. Don't you agree, Ray?
Yes, definitely. Yes. I mean, so many times we've had the festival and the director forgot to do the music clearance or whatever, and they get stuck, and yeah, it's hard. It's hard.
I mean, bands have been there themselves. They've all started from nothing and needed a break in life. They're prepared to help up-and-coming producers and directors normally as well. You know, what they don't like is a 10 million or 100 million pound film, you know, offering them £3,000
for a film. Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's the thing.
No, and a lot of these emerging filmmakers, we had this discussion the other day in a talk with my son, actually, on a film that he did a number of years ago, and he desperately wanted this one, and he went directly to the band. He made sure he was in a place where they knew that there, and went up to them and, you know, just pleaded their case. And we've got so many stories of that with, you know, emerging filmmakers who who just really fight for the music, because they are better educated in many ways on what they want. And but you got to be hungry. You got to go for it.
Yeah, yeah. And you got to have a really good project and really believe in yourself. Mm, yeah, too, you know, yeah. And have a good case. You have to have a good case.
It's been absolutely brilliant listening to you and talk about your careers. And I just want to say thank you so much to Michelle and Rupert for joining us.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Jace.
Hey, Jason. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Just buried in paperwork.
Oh, for the sync report.
Not this time. Move me no mountain.
That indie film you're music supervising?
Yeah.
Sounds like a great project. What's the problem?
It's a brilliant film and we're building a great soundtrack, but you can't imagine how much paperwork I deal with for these films.
Have you heard of Sync Lodge?
First, you got to draft up the sync request forms.
I've heard of Sync Lodge.
Then drafting and issuing contracts.
Yep, Sync Lodge is great, Paula. It does everything a music supervisor needs.
Then deliver the cue sheet. It never ends.
Doesn't Sync Lodge do all of that automatically?
Sweat Lodge? What are you guys banging on about? I got real issues I'm sharing with you guys.
Yeah, lots of issues.
We're trying to tell you, Jason, Sync Lodge is a new platform for music supervisors. It helps you to source the music, sync songs against scenes, draft up sync requests, and even creates the cue sheets once you've locked in the music to the film.
Whoa, Sync Lodge does all that?
It's true, Jason. I just started using it for the sync report. And it's not only saving time, but it's so easy to use, I'm actually enjoying the work.
You guys are the best. Sync Lodge sounds amazing and exactly what I need for music supervising. Why am I always the last one to hear about these things?
I've been telling you about Sync Lodge for weeks.
Don't feel bad, Edge, for not telling me sooner. I know you're busy. You're a good guy.
Paula, is my mic on? Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Edge.
Guys, what's the name of that program again?
Sync Lodge.
That is something to scream about. Yes, you too can be cool like Edge and use cutting edge technology to help you with your film and TV productions. No matter if you're a music supervisor, director, producer, editor, save time and increase proficiency with Sync Lodge.
I need to find a new gig.
Sync opportunities.
Welcome to the Sync Report. Thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight. We are listening to Christmas music. It's going to be so much fun. Let us get things started. Let us say hello to every one of my gorgeous crew and cast members. Hello, Paula Flack. How is France?
Hello there. It's very good, thank you.
I see you're spending lots of time on the beach.
We're trying to spend as much time on the beach as we can.
Cut and crabs, huh?
Drink, oof, get crabs. We're catching crabs, yeah.
Yeah, I told you not to mingle with the locals.
And drink as much wine as possible. That's just the kids.
Ooh, good. Are we on drinks tonight? Is everyone drinking with me?
I have been drinking a little bit of French cider and French wine.
Ooh,
this
cider.
Afternoon, that's this evening.
That's like alcohol made from apples, right?
Basically, yes. My favorite.
The whitest of white trash drinks, I think.
Totally. I love it.
Yeah, I love it. You are my goddess. Vinks, tell us a little bit about this. What's happening in October? What is the package?
No, it's November the 7th to the 13th. And we have a bunch of great filmmakers and music supervisors giving us briefs and learning how to communicate. And it's at a studio, a vineyard, and we hold a lot of people. The food is included. It's the whole thing. It doesn't cost much. And all you got to do is fly into Toulouse and we get you from there. And it's a beautiful thing. And I think we only got 5 spots left. There's a bunch of records going up and we're working with Tuck and Patty, which is, I don't know if you guys are too young to know all that kind of stuff, but there's some beautiful artists coming and producers and lyricists and poets and all kinds of things. So we're going to do a kind of not a sleepover. I don't know what you guys call it, but we're a bunch of musicians and artists come together and we just get a mission. We get a brief and we go for it. And we learn how to process the information that they're giving us. And they also learn how to ask us better what they want, you know, to realize that if they don't ask us as musicians, we might give them something that they didn't even think about that might be more perfect than they could imagine. But that's part of the process. Half the rooms have workstations in them already, and they're all connected to the main studios in the mastering room and everything else. So it's a big facility. It's really amazing. It's one of those things where the German oligarch kind of spends money for his son to get it together. And so we turned this beautiful place into something that we can all afford to do and come together. And it's I'm so excited. Just go to vinx.com or I'll put the one of the links up on the chat.
Yes, let's do that.
But it's the second week. It's the Sync Report week, which is from the 7th to the 13th. The first week is just making songwriters better and get them prepared for the next group of stuff on the second week. So it's great. I'm really excited. Some amazing artists are coming. So you're going to have, just imagine if you could think of an idea and all you have to do is say, okay, who can do this? Who can do that? And you got everything you need in the same place. You could knock a demo out so fast, because you got people from Istanbul and Switzerland and Madagascar and Mozambique and all and over
Brazil, that cool guy.
Brazil is right. Yeah, Argentina. We got. So it's a pretty wide.
People from around the world are coming. It's so
and exciting. One of the guys, Gray Bashu, which you guys, he got a placement from this room. You guys put him
right in Move Me No Mountain.
Yes. So he's there, of course. And so I'm excited. A lot of my Berklee students are coming as well. So
we've heard a bit. Let's talk to a couple of people we've already had the pleasure of hearing their beautiful voices. Hello, Letha.
Hello. Vinx,
how are you?
I put vinx.com in the chat. And I'm interested in going as well, but I have to kind of clear it with my husband first, because
Ivo,
it's another trip that
Yeah, you're just jet setting around the world. I think it's gonna be cheaper to buy a private plane at this point. We're gonna jump into the holiday music, but I must say hello to two more of my faves. Hello, Jody.
Hello, everyone. How are you today?
Thriving.
I want to give pulsating. A shout out to my buddy Mickey for 13 points today.
Is everything going on? Is the weather okay for you?
Yes, it's actually a little warm, but it's beautiful. But I am also keeping track of something else, too. I'm keeping track of your dirty jokes. 12 right now. So I'm keeping a running record.
Oh, my God. I got to hit 30.
Yeah, let's see how many we can hit.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And I know there's new music that you're working on. I'm actually, when I get out of this gorgeous room of ours, I'm going to be going to my happy place listening to Jody tonight. I think Jody has something very special that works. Hopefully we're going to be premiering that baby on the show soon. And last but not least, the gorgeous, the stunning, the multi-talented, the woman who puts up with a lot of harassment in this room. Hello, Heather.
Hello, hello. How are you?
How are you doing? You're in Canada as well.
I am in Canada. I'm pretty good. Nothing to report. I had a lychee martini today.
Ooh, what is a lychee martini?
I really don't know what they put in it, except that it's delicious. And there's
I only know the one lychees. With the olives.
I hate olives.
Me too. I don't like olives either. My brother and sister used to put those olives on their fingers and chase me around.
That's a good reason not to like olives. I just don't like them because I don't like the texture.
I have scar tissue because of olives. Jabbing on. Let's have our panelists, Kev, Vinx. Are you guys ready to be judging?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, baby. Oh, yeah.
I do want to say something before we start off, because we do have an event coming up ourselves in September.
Oh, right. What is that?
Since we're going international.
We are international.
For this episode, I mean, man, it'd be great to have Vinx over to Dublin for our upcoming concert.
But Vinx doesn't have to dance because he's...
because I don't have no twerker's compensation.
I got you on percussions.
Someone right needs to write that song.
Right next to the rabbis, the nuns, and the Rastas.
Perfect.
Wait till you see this nutty show. So yeah, that's been fun, Kev. So I think great idea. We must get Vinx to Dublin. September 15th, headlining Patty Casey, who we've actually had on the podcast, with support from Stephanie Rainey, that amazing Irish artist that we also brought into Clubhouse. And her single is, oh my God, charting out here. This woman's incredible. And of course, Colin O'Donoghue is hosting. Milfredo 7 is DJing the after party. Wonka, wonka, wonka. And who knows? There might be other special guests. Paula, what do you think? I think our promoters are like bringing in special guests for that show.
I do believe they are.
Oh, yeah. They're working hard.
I don't believe we can say who just yet.
What do you think? Should we get ready? Should we do it?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Thank you, Paula. No, I'm with you. I needed permission. Oh, wait. Paula.
You're on a roll today.
Who are we indulging tonight?
We are playing Belle Wilder and Sharing Christmas. Play it, Milfredo.
Snow is falling. Ooh, ooh, ooh. So let's snuggle up by the fire. Our friends are calling. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Filling our every desire. Family's coming. Ooh, ooh, ooh. We're home with those who we love. Our hearts are warming.
Welcome back, Mark.
Mark's thanks, ignoring guys. Sorry.
Mark.
Yeah. So that track is written by Adrian Bellis and I, and together we are Belle Wilder. It's a total nostalgic romp. It's got a lot of influences of Beatles, I'm sure you heard, and influences of, you know, older music, even than that, 50s and maybe even 40s. But we want to do something modern at the same time. So it's certainly that. And I'm the co-writer, and I'm also the producer and the orchestrator.
Honestly, I had a lot of fun during that song. I really enjoyed it. Thank you, Mark, for sharing that with us. Now let's see if I am, like normal, the oddball out. Kev, what do you think?
No, you are not the oddball out. Yay, on this song. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for specifying for this song.
You're never the odd. I like being the oddball out, actually. So, you know, I'm an outlier.
That's just what's happening in my trousers.
Just keep it
16,
going.
Jody.
Mark, I really, really enjoyed that song. And, for you know, the throwback, I felt it 100%. But it also felt modern at the same time. And I do talk about, you know, things that are distinctly different, although it was kind of a throwback to those eras, the 40s and the 50s. It did have some kind of, you know, punchy vibe to it that felt modern. And it's definitely something that we don't have that type of song. We don't have that yet. So no. For me, that goes in the A slot for us. It goes in the bag for sure.
Like a swish. Swish.
Just like a swish.
Into the bag.
Right in the bag.
So, yeah, thank you for providing something we don't have at the moment. And wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Paula, I think we're coming down to our last two.
We're going to play one last song, and then we're going to have a couple of
two for room
submissions. Yes.
Great.
So the last song that was sent in advance is Close for Christmas by The Aftershocks featuring Josiah Ruff. Spin it, Wilfredo.
I heard a my favorite Christmas song. Wish you were here to sing along. Been apart for quite a while. Busy lives got in the way. Don't wanna lose more precious time. So I hope this holiday will be together finally. What matters most is family. I would walk a million frozen miles to feel the warmth and see your joyful smile. The lonely distance, nothing could stop how far I'd go. I just want to be close for Christmas. Close for Christmas. Just want to be the message written in our hearts. From a car, 'cause it's gonna change this year. We'll be standing face to face. The love we share will be right here. Nothing standing in the way. We'll be together finally. What matters most is
For me, you know, because I listen to the songs, and not just for where it sits in the movie, but also the artist that it can be forwarded to and things like that. And that's a perfect song for one, like a Jamie Cullum, and a, for, you know, another version of that. If you take six, they would take that with the voices and just give you the whole symphonic effect and the counter melodies that you have going there. And I think it's a beautiful opportunity in that way. For a lot of people are looking for beautiful grown folk kind of attention, and when the music is still in the music. So I appreciated that. You know, maybe if Robert Glasper was going to do a new Christmas project, that'd be somebody else who might be interested in that kind of movement.
Grab the mic, Robert.
Testing. Hello.
Yay, we got you.
Sorry, guys. I'm not home at the moment. I was at the beach, so I was having some issues with my phone. Thank you so much for playing the song.
Yeah, thank you for the submission. Please do a little introduction and tell us a bit about that track.
Okay, well, I'm a songwriter from the Bahamas. I co-wrote that with Jennifer Jardine. She's from LA. We wrote that last year, actually. We had quite a bit of Christmas tunes. We wrote that one. Someone said, take six. I'm kind of, that'll be an honor. But I guess we're kind of heading for a Boyz II Men situation. So definitely a classic kind of R&B. The singer really did a great job, especially at the end with those counter melodies. The tempo demo had some of it, but he really took it over the edge, I thought.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Paula, who is next?
Ooh, well, next up, we're going to be listening to Izzy Spring, Home for the Holidays. Ooh. Play it, Milfredo.
All my time off work, it's different now. Gotta keep it cool, but don't slow down. Remember to call and say hello, hello, hello. Gotta keep it high, but take it slow. Christmas, when everything's on fire and everyone's a liar. Can we admit we don't miss this? Let's pretend it's Halloween and say just what we mean. I don't wanna be home for the holidays. All my relatives are different now. Gotta choke all my opinions down. No, I really miss my grandma. Maybe staying inside is cool if I can hide all. But it doesn't feel like Christmas when everything's on fire and everyone's a liar. Can we admit we don't miss this? Let's pretend it's Halloween and say just what we mean. I don't wanna be home for the holidays. I don't have many good associations with it, except when I spend Hanukkah with friends. When everything's on fire and everyone's a liar. Can we admit we don't miss this? Let's pretend it's Halloween and say just what we mean. I don't wanna be. No, I don't wanna be home for the holidays.
The angelic voices in this room tonight, absolutely incredible. Izzy, welcome to our stage.
Hello, first time.
Hello, how are you?
I'm really good. Thank you guys for listening to it.
Oh my God. If I would have only known what a singer you were when I was first connected with you, we would have been doing something other than fashion. That's for sure.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you.
Beautiful. Why don't you give a little introduction? Tell us what was the inspiration behind that song?
Oh yeah. Well, hello everyone. I'm Izzy. I was working with Universal and they were trying to push me like, the holidays are coming up. You've got to write a song. You've got to write a song, make like a happy, bubbly Christmas song. And it was the middle of the pandemic and I just was feeling like awful. I was just like feeling this sort of like misery and dread coming up for the holidays, mostly because, Christmas has never been a particularly happy time for me. I love my more immediate family. Yeah, it's like, it's weird. We like kind of, it's glorified a lot in a lot of different songs, and I just never super related to it. My favorite holiday has always been the same as my mom's, which is Halloween. She actually got married on Halloween.
Me too. No way. That's
we.
No way.
Wait, really?
Unbelievable. That's
crazy.
Yeah.
And yeah, Halloween's a great day to get married. Side note, because it makes the coolest anniversary. But yeah, I think I was just sitting there and I was like, I would so much prefer Halloween right now. I wrote it, and I think my label's response was like, well, it's something. It's not happy. And I was like, no, it's not. The one thing about me is like, the only thing you're going to get out of me is authenticity. Even if it means like people don't like it.
No way. So important as an artist. No, that is the first commitment that you have to yourself and your art. So, well, good for you for sticking to your guns.
Thank you.
Not every holiday song has to be bubbly and happy. And, you know, we all obviously, I think many of us can relate to you, you know, not having the most happiest of Christmas on. All right, Vinks, bring the rockets, bring the bazookas. What do you got to say?
First off, I love her voice. I love that she's a great storyteller. You know, as a connoisseur of lyrics, I think she's a great lyricist. And she told a great story. She inferred it. She didn't tell us. She showed us, what for me is very important. I wanted for her to be more dramatic for the pain, so I could really understand and appreciate the punchline of, I don't really like Christmas, because she explained to us why, the pain of that, because we all feel that. If you've ever lost a parent or somebody you love, Christmas is not the same anymore. So we all have that experience of it. And I thought you did a great job, Izzy, of being uniquely yourself, the difference from gourmet and fast food. And yours, you know, you gotta book the room and go in and order that table, because you can't eat there every day because it's expensive and it's way more quality than the fast food. I appreciate you very much.
Oh my gosh, y'all are making my day. Oh my gosh.
Congratulations to all the lovely, talented songwriters and friends in our community who participated in Name That Soundtrack. I'm glad you'll be getting your NFT. Do contact Paula if you are going to set up your MetaMask wallet and go through the process. Or if you're just up there for shits and giggles, great. Hopefully you got a laugh or two. Everybody on the stage, I love, 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 love you guys. Have a great day, evening, whatever the case may be. Thanks for spending your time with us, and we'll see you next Sunday.
Thank you to our listeners for spending time with us. The Sync Report cast will be back with you next week with Rose Ganguza, Jason P. Rothberg, and myself, Colin O'Donoghue. Until next time, take care and be kind. And thank you again, Michelle and Rupert. It's been absolutely brilliant.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.
Today's episode was produced by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Paula Flack, and Robert Capadonna. It was written by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Lisa Dunn, and Paula Flack. Editing was by Jason P. Rothberg, Milfredo Seven, Paula Flack, Edgar Edge Kamei, and Adam McNamara. Research by Lisa Dunn. Graphic design by Jody Lynn Talevi. Brought to you by Zavatar.